You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. As we near what we hope will be the end of the 2020 election, there are increasing concerns about its fairness. Here in Wisconsin, as with other states, there have been last-minute changes to voting rules that could have a major impact on how legal votes are counted. Efforts to suppress voting aren't new in the U.S. But in a contentious election like the one happening right now, these tactics can mean the difference between winning or losing an election. Paru Shah is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, and she joins me now to talk about historical and modern voter suppression tactics. Paru, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to start with a kind of big question that I think has a lot of answers. When we think about the history of voter suppression in the United States, what does that look like? What's included in that?
Yeah, no, that's a kind of brings us back a couple hundred years. You know, I think when people look to the first instances of voter suppression, they look to the end of the Civil War and the first time that African Americans really were given the right to vote. And I think one of the downsides, or maybe I would say one of the kind of consequences of a federalist system like we have in the United States, where states get to make a lot of decisions about who gets to vote, what the procedures are for registration, what are the requirements for voting, really then set up a system where different states created different barriers for voters. And I think what we see kind of happening immediately after the Civil Rights War ends are these kind of barriers or institutions put into place to make it more difficult to vote, particularly for African Americans at that time. And I would say that a lot of those continued through 1965 with the Voter Rights Act. But so things that people I think are most probably aware of are poll taxes and literacy tests and kind of ways in which individuals had to prove their ability to be able to vote based on, you know, some knowledge of what was happening and or ability to pay. And these were all, I think, really subjective. I think that's, I think, another key piece of this is that the individuals, the clerks who were making those decisions had a lot of leeway in, you know, who they passed and who they didn't. And so all of these really kind of set up a system where individuals had the right based on a federal law that they had the right to vote, but then states created additional barriers and were allowed to deny that right to vote over time.
Of course, we had the Voter Rights Act in the 1960s. Some of that has been, you know, chipped away at over the decades since that was passed. And we see, you know, in modern times, especially the last couple of decades, new ways of parties trying to suppress the vote. When we compare modern voter suppression to what we saw kind of post Civil War, how do those two compare?
No, I think you're right. I think that I think one of the kind of insidious ways in which voter suppression works is there's always individuals and groups working to limit who gets to vote. And as the federal government and others, you know, are working to expand it, there's an equal kind of power that's trying to contract it at the same time. And the Voting Rights Act really addressed things like literacy tests and poll taxes. But I think what you see nowadays are things like voter ID laws, the reduction in the number of polling places, the reduction in the number of times polling places are open. In this election in particular, there has been, I would say, the most confusion I've ever seen in an election around when you can vote, how you can vote, when your vote would be counted. That level of confusion, I think, really adds to a suppression technique, which is working towards people who are, you know, most likely waiting till later to vote, like to vote in person, and are unclear about what their avenues to vote are. But I think all of those post 1965 and probably kind of moving into now have had really similar effects in terms of voter suppression. One of the things that people like to look at from, you know, pre-Voting Rights Act to post is Mississippi. where the Black voting registration and voter turnout went from, I want to say, 13% to 65%. So that level of suppression probably isn't happening today as widely. But we know, based on the 2016 election, that here in Wisconsin, the voter ID law and other tactics had a negative influence, particularly around voters of color and young voters and the most elderly. So the most marginalized, for other reasons, are also going to then get marginalized in terms of voting rights. And I think in this 2020 election, because of COVID, the change in polling locations or restriction in polling locations, and I think, again, the confusion around how to vote and how it will be counted will probably have the most impact as well.
There are a lot of questions about how things will be counted, if things will be counted, and I want to get back to that in a moment. But one of the things that we've seen a resurgence of as a result of President Trump is this idea of poll watching. He has suggested to people who support him that they go and watch polls. Can you tell us about the history of poll watching?
Yeah, and I think there's an interesting dynamic here, because I think originally, you know, poll watchers were sent out to ensure that there wasn't any sort of fraudulent kind of activity or people weren't being denied the right to vote, you know, like that the federal government's Voting Rights Act was being upheld, particularly in the South. So when I think about kind of the history of poll watching, it was to ensure voters had the right to vote. As part of Jim Crow and prior to the Voting Rights Act, the intimidation and threat of violence has also, though, been used to suppress the vote. And so that has a long history. And my sense of what we will potentially see on November 3rd is more of this intimidation. So rather than using poll watchers to ensure that voters have the right to vote, these would be individuals who are there trying to intimidate voters and make them less likely to either go to the poll or feel like their rights are being, or that they're being watched in terms of, do they have the right identification? Are they a felon? Are they at the right polling place? You know, I think that's the kind of, because of the way Trump discussed the idea of poll watching and this idea of kind of catching fraud, I would imagine that this is what we might see across the country in terms of poll watching.
It does seem like his calls are more about intimidation. I've heard, I don't think specifically from the president, but from some of his followers, the idea of bringing up the Second Amendment, bringing guns to watch the polls, theoretically. It does seem sinister in nature. What has been the impact of this kind of voter intimidation in the past?
So in the past, it could be that it has convinced people not to go in or intimidated people as they were walking in to turn around and walk away. I can't recall a modern election where there was violence at a polling place based on poll watchers. The ones that I've seen, so I can say that I've volunteered with the ACLU for many years to watch election polls here in Wisconsin. And most often, the ways in which they're trying to intimidate are really around the voter ID and this idea that you're not actually supposed to be registered here to vote. And as long as the clerks and the individuals working at the polls feel like they have enough information and can push back on that rhetoric, I think that has always worked. I've never seen anybody in Wisconsin with armed or threatening violence. So that being said, you know, we're an open and carry state. And so I don't know what's going to happen on the 3rd, because people could be walking around with weapons outside of polling places. But my guess would be that then that would, you know, lead to additional local police showing up as well to control any sort of violence that might happen. But I can't recall a modern election where any of that has happened.
It is an atypical election in that way. I also can't think of a modern president who would have said anything like that beyond, of course, President Trump.
Sure. I think that's right.
So when we think about these tactics of voter suppression, we're generally talking about things that are barriers to the polls themselves. You, of course, mentioned voter ID, which is something that we have here in the state of Wisconsin. You mentioned access to ballot boxes in general or polling places. But something that we're seeing right now is this kind of fight to discredit votes that have already been cast. Can you talk a bit about that?
So are you talking about the votes that have been cast by mail already?
Votes that have been cast by mail, but also the process of counting votes, which are legal votes.
You know, I think that, again, we have the most, I think I read this morning that 80 million ballots have been cast already. And so we are well on our way to surpass our voter turnout from 2016. And it will, you know, outmatch the number of ballots cast by mail or early by a large margin this year. And so I think one of the concerns originally was, do we have the capacity to capture all these votes early? And I think that because we had primary elections throughout the spring, I think states are prepared for what it's going to look like in terms of having to go through all these early ballots. But I think it also means that we're not going to know potentially the outcome of an election on the same day, that it could take a couple days to find out. I don't think that there's any evidence of fraud based on mail-in voting, and there hasn't been in the past. The numbers are quite, I mean, very, very, very low in terms of fraud based on this. And so I think the issue will be about, in part, about the timing of counting the votes and the delay and how that kind of is then, if the election ends up being close, it could, you know, lead to more speculation about, well, are we going to need a recount versus if it's moving in one direction pretty solidly, then I think, you know, there'll be less concern about, well, if there's a few ballots that, you know, we still need to count in this one state, we can still do it. But it's not going to necessarily change the outcome of the election.
There's a concern in part because prominent Republicans like President Trump have stated that they want the complete count to be on election day, that if it isn't on election day, then they're going to question its legitimacy. And we even have a Supreme Court justice who is calling for a fast count, a count on election day. Is that something that we've had in the past? Because it doesn't seem like it.
Yeah, and we haven't because we haven't had this volume of early votes before. So we never had to think through, like, well, what if we can't do everything on election night? It's, I mean, we've always been able to, we knew we could do it, and the number of mail-in votes in most states were not significant enough to potentially change the outcome of that state. You know, I think that this is a tactic being used by our president in particular to put into question outcomes that at this point are, he probably knows and polls suggest are going to be unfavorable for him. But every state gets to make a decision, again, because states make their own laws about how votes are cast and counted. States get to make a decision about how long they will allow absentee ballots or mail-in ballots to come in post-election time and when they will count them. So, for example, here in Wisconsin, we will count them after all the other ballots are counted. Other states count them first. Some states say, well, we're going to wait until you have to postmark it by the 3rd. Here in Wisconsin, it has to be delivered by the 3rd. So I think because we know that there's all this variance in those decisions, it's not going to be possible this year probably to have the outcome. And I think they're using this again as another tactic to, you know, I think create anxiety and uncertainty about the election as a way to suggest that people, those kinds of tactics, I think, really do work to suppress the vote in the sense that there are always people who feel like, is it worth it to vote? And uncertainty, I think, increases the likelihood that they think, well, I'm not going to bother then.
So when we look at how the vote will be counted in a state like Wisconsin, does the federal government really have the ability to step in afterward and say, well, because you weren't able to count all of your mail-in votes on election day, those don't count?
My guess is no, but I don't know like where the federal government could step in. I would think have to first go to the courts before a final decision could be made. But again, because we've always allowed states to make these decisions, this is a national election that happens at the state level. So states still get to make, all their own rules. And as far as I know, I don't see how the federal government could come in unless they are going to claim some sort of violation of the Voting Rights Act or some sort of voter intimidation or, something like that, where the Department of Justice could say, we need to step in. But if it's around, when the votes are counted, that seems to not be something that violates anything that we currently have in federal law.
Hmm. All right. Well, Paru, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thanks for having me.
Paru Shah is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. You can hear more of her analysis during WUWM's special election night coverage starting at 6 o'clock.